to support this NPR station.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loray. Well, the longest war ever fought by the U.S. is still going on. It's the war in Afghanistan. What are the aims of the war, and what will it take for the war to come to an end? Today, we'll talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Steve Call about his new book on the largely overlooked war in Afghanistan. But first, lots of listener comments about my interview yesterday with the new chair of the Hillsborough County Republican Party about the party's upcoming Second Amendment barbecue. The event was originally called a shootout. It's an effort to support the Second Amendment to the Constitution. Part of yesterday's discussion was whether the founders of the country who wrote the Second Amendment envisioned millions of semi-automatic weapons in the hands of Americans. Here's what several listeners had to say following yesterday's show.
This is in reference to your program Tuesday morning. Your guest, I guess he's now going to be the new head of the Republican Party in Hillsborough County. And the only thing I can say, Rob, is that's very frustrating, disappointing, and it disgusts me. People like him, that's why we have problems in Tallahassee and in Congress in D.C. I'm just frustrated. I think it's sad we have people like him in charge of a whole party in Hillsborough County. This is Fred in St. Pete.
I was just reading in the Tampa Tribune today that the AR-15 has a muzzle velocity rate of approximately 3 times a normal handgun. And when a person is hit with that gun, shot, the exit wound from that weapon is about the size of an orange, as opposed to a 22, which your gentleman is comparing to an AR-15. Leaves like a little knife cut instead of a hole the size of a orange. So I don't know where he's coming from and where he's getting his information, but as an Air Force colonel, you would think he would be more in tune and more aware of what actually happens with an AR-15.
This is Elizabeth in Riverview. About your retired colonel today. Most of the callers in spotted him for exactly what he is, thank heavens. I am the widow of an Air Force officer, and during our military career, I always considered myself a civilian. I couldn't stand anyone over the rank of colonel, because most of them thought as that gentleman did. He actually referred in his comments to these massacres as incidents, like they were an act of God. Unfortunately, that's what many of them thought. I'm sorry to say it, but it's true.
Even at St. Pete, I was just listening to the show, and you made a fantastic comment to the one caller. Where do you draw the line? And I've been using that argument also. Let's say I could afford an Abrams tank, and I want to have it in my front yard and buy one. And, of course, it's for home defense to protect my family. And I'm on the crime prevention watch in my neighborhood to stop hooligans and burglaries. So I want to own an Abrams tank. Can I own an Abrams tank? Well, let's say I have my eye on a restored Harrier jet. Perfect for me. Okay, because I have a lot of trees in my backyard, so I could land it like a helicopter because the street is not long enough to take off. So I can come in and come down with my Harrier jet, only for neighborhood defense. And let's say I wanted to have grenade launchers on it and chemical weapons and limited nuclear weapons on it. Where do you draw the line? And this takes us back to this argument. The government, the military, and law enforcement hold the gun. That's the way society in the history of the world to keep civilization civil. Now, we might not always agree with our government. We might have many disagreements with our government, okay? And that's where direct democracy, public forums, hear he, and you talk about it. And if that doesn't do anything, then you use civil disobedience. And everything comes down to, with this argument, with the gun freak mentality, it is fear and rebellion that they live in.
It's Bill in St. Pete. I am also a former commissioned officer in the infantry and served 12 months with the 1st Infantry Division in the bush in Vietnam. Needless to say, I saw a lot of employment of an M16 5.56 round. Within the service, there's a lot of inter-service rivalry and a lot of joking around and so forth and jokes about other services. But in this case, I found his entire presentation embarrassing for a commissioned officer in the armed forces. His level of knowledge was, I just can't imagine that this man was actually a colonel, even if it was in the Air Force, which is it certainly stands one distance removed from ground combat. I mean, primarily, they fly airplanes. In any event, I just found this very embarrassing, and I'm really sorry it actually took place because it doesn't make commissioned officers in the armed forces look very good.
This is Joe from St. Petersburg. I'd like to address this well-regulated militia thing. Everybody thinks that it's the Second Amendment that gives ordinary law-abiding citizens the right to bear arms. My understanding is the constitutional ruling in the 30s. Back to the well-regulated militia. You got that part right. But here's my take on the whole thing. If you download a PDF version of the Constitution and bring up your favorite reader and do a word search for militia, you will find that it's mentioned four times. And for Elizabeth's benefit, I'm going to give you the article and section numbers. The first three times is in the same section, Article 1, Section 8. The last time is in Article 2, Section 2. The first time it's used, I'm going to read it to you because it's short. To provide for the calling forth of the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. Okay, then you have to go to well-regulated. Well, what is the definition of that? That sounds kind of vague. Well, the only sensible explanation is we have 50 well-regulated militias that are already armed. It's called the National Guard.
My name's Phil. The program you had today was pretty unbelievable, for lack of a better word. And the one guy's comment, they called in, I'm ashamed to say I was in the United States Air Force. You know, and this guy's a colonel. I mean, I'm a little bit like you. I, went and shot woodchucks till I was, 14, 15. I've seen the damage at 22 does, and it ain't nothing. I personally haven't seen an AR-15, but to even put the two together, ah.
There you have a lot of listener comments about yesterday's program. You can also tell us what you thought of yesterday's interview with the incoming head of the Hillsborough Republican Party. You can write us now at dj@wmnf.org. Well, the U.S. and a coalition of nations invaded Afghanistan in 2001, shortly after the 9/11 attack. Even though the 9/11 hijackers were mostly Saudi nationals, the U.S. was trying to get the perceived mastermind of the 9/11 attack, Osama bin Laden, who was said to be living in Afghanistan under the protection of the Taliban and al-Qaeda. The National Priorities website lists the cost of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan at $800 billion so far. More than 110,000 Afghans, civilians, soldiers, and militants have been killed in the conflict, and the Cost of War Project estimates that the number who have died through indirect causes related to the war may be as high as 360,000. 2,400 U.S. military personnel have been killed in Afghanistan so far since 2001. 3,500 coalition personnel have been killed. Our guest today is Pulitzer Prize-winning author Steve Call, and he's going to discuss the 17-year history of America's efforts to defeat al-Qaeda and the Taliban in Afghanistan and Pakistan since 9/11. His new book is called Directorate S, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Directorate S delivers original reporting to tell the story of the secret relationship between the U.S. and ISI, the Pakistani intelligence service that nurtured the Taliban and thwarted American ambitions in Afghanistan. Steve Call, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
The Afghanistan war is the longest U.S. war, certainly among the most costliest in terms of both lives and also national treasure. What is the ultimate aim of the U.S. in Afghanistan?
Well, it's a question we've really struggled with across three administrations. What are our war aims? One aspect has always been the clearest, which is it's a counterterrorism mission. So as long as there are internationally dangerous terrorist groups in Afghanistan or near Afghanistan, we have had that as our goal to try to suppress them. Al-Qaeda, now a little branch of the Islamic State in eastern Afghanistan. But the muddle has really been around other aims. So we're trying to allow the Afghan constitutional government and its security services to prevail in their long civil war against the Taliban. And we do that by providing them assistance, including an air force, effectively our air force is their air force. And that war has been a grind. I mean, it has been a stalemate for a decade. And despite a huge surge of combat troops in 2011-2012, at the peak, we were 150,000 international combat troops fighting on the ground in Afghanistan, largely against the Taliban, not against Al-Qaeda. And they really didn't change the map. You know, it's a dilemma of the war that our commanders go out there one after another, and they say, they readily say, you know, there's probably no purely military solution to this war. We're going to have to find some kind of a political strategy. And yet we haven't been able to identify a political strategy, and so the war just grinds on.
Well, I thought we went in Afghanistan looking for Al-Qaeda and looking for Osama bin Laden. The U.S., under some people think mysterious circumstances, and you address it a bit in your book, took out Osama bin Laden. So if we took out Osama bin Laden, why are we still there?
Well, the commanders of the war in Afghanistan would say that the reason is that there's still a lot of other dangerous international terrorist groups, including remnants of Al-Qaeda under new leadership in the region, and that they pose a threat to the United States. But, you know, it is a problem that has recurred through administration after administration as they try to review their strategy in the war. They come to question, well, is there really enough of a danger in this theater to justify the sacrifices of American soldiers and the expenditure of such vast sums of money? And, you know, one of the problems, and here's a good example. In 2009, the Obama administration went through a series of strategy reviews about the war. And in secret, in these discussions, they identified two vital interests of the United States in Afghanistan, interests so strong that it would justify the sacrifices of American military personnel. One was Al-Qaeda, which was still carrying out international attacks, and the other was the security of Pakistan's nuclear weapons. Didn't want them to fall into the wrong hands. Well, in 2009, neither of those problems or worries was actually in Afghanistan. They were both across the border in Pakistan because Al-Qaeda had fled there after the 2001 war. And, of course, Pakistan's nuclear weapons are in Pakistan. So then they said, well, why are we fighting in Afghanistan if the things that really matter to us are in Pakistan? And the answer was, well, if Afghanistan falls back into chaos, Al-Qaeda will come back. All right? Plausible fear, but kind of an indirect reason to fight a war. And I think what it suggests is that the war aims problem, especially about the Taliban's place in the war, you know, has just really been persistent over a long period of time.
Okay, you talked about two groups, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Let's talk about Al-Qaeda for a moment. Is Al-Qaeda largely self-funded, or is it funded by Saudi Arabia and the Sunni factions in that part of the world?
Different answers at different times and places. Al-Qaeda is kind of a franchise network. The core group started out in the Afghan region, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and it clearly raised money from the Gulf, from Saudi individuals and from charities and Muslim charities and from other Gulf states and from other radical Sunni networks. Over time, you know, it splintered and it had branches grow up in places like Yemen that were very ambitious and in North Africa. And those branches funded themselves by different means in North Africa. Kidnapping and ransom payments from European governments was one way that they were able to acquire millions of dollars. There's evidence that Al-Qaeda, even in Afghanistan, was looking to make money off of kidnapping rackets and other criminal activity. They, I think, managed to maintain a donor network, but it got harder as the war in Afghanistan proceeded. So they, you know, the Taliban, I think, have a much more rich source of self-finance. They're embedded in the countryside. They can tax the drug trade, and they also have a network of businesses and sympathizers in the Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia, but also United Arab Emirates and other places.
But just going back to Al-Qaeda for a moment, what's their ultimate aim? I mean, do they want to be a regional power? Do they want to set up a caliphate in that part of the world? Or are they bent on world domination? I'm still trying to figure out why we spend so many American lives, 100,000 Afghan lives, fighting groups like Al-Qaeda. What is Al-Qaeda's ultimate aim?
Well, Al-Qaeda was kind of a millenarian group that had a theory of itself as kind of a vanguard of a worldwide Islamic revolution, and that their role was to, you know, take on the big enemy, the United States, sort of like, you know, the rebels in Star Wars going at the Death Star. They saw themselves as the you know, the radical vanguard of a coming, you know, ordained triumph of Islamic government. But what they didn't do was set up a government of their own. So they were very much focused on violence, and a lot of their victims, the greatest number of their victims, were fellow Muslims, and they became, I think, unpopular because of that. They're not like Hezbollah, for example, in Lebanon, that runs social services and really sees itself as accountable to its followers. And even the Islamic State, for all of its brutality, it succeeded where Al-Qaeda didn't, in holding territory and saying, well, this is the caliphate, come join us. So Al-Qaeda was really overtaken by the Islamic State's rise, and even now the Islamic State in Afghanistan is, you know, a factor, and Al-Qaeda is still a smaller faction. I mean, it's still, Al-Qaeda still matters, but I think the Islamic State has become the main concern of kind of counterterrorism planners in the U.S.
And without Osama bin Laden, is Al-Qaeda a shadow of what it was?
Yeah, I think it's diminished. It hasn't disappeared, and it still has a leadership and a communications arm. It still tries to carry out attacks. It was probably the most dangerous out of Yemen toward the second term of the Obama administration, when a preacher who had American roots named Anwar al-Awlaki was carrying out these kind of package bomb attacks on the U.S. that he almost blew up an airliner over Detroit on Christmas Day. So they're still around, but I think, you know, when you look at the violence in the world that has been caused by these kinds of groups over the last few years, the slaughter in Paris and Brussels, that has come out of the Syrian war and under the banner of the Islamic State.
We're talking with Steve Call, who is the author of a brand new book called Directorate S, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So the other group we're fighting in Afghanistan is the Taliban. Is that the remnant of the group that we subsidized to fight the Soviets in the late 1970s?
Yeah, in a way. In the 1970s, but mostly in the 1980s, the CIA worked with Pakistani intelligence to run guns and money to the Afghan Mujahideen, and they did pressure the Soviets enough so that the Soviets withdrew. Then a civil war ensued among the factions that we had armed. And out of that civil war rose the Taliban, and they took over almost all of Afghanistan, and Al-Qaeda kind of found sanctuary in Taliban-ruled Afghanistan, and then came 9/11. Then we threw the Taliban out, and the surviving leadership went to Pakistan and hunkered down. And then gradually they came back, and they basically saw themselves as having been thrown out unjustly by the United States, because they said, look, we weren't responsible for 9/11. There were no Afghans on those planes. They claimed they didn't even know about the attacks. And so they see themselves fighting a war of liberation in their own country, trying to reestablish the government that we overthrew in 2001.
These were Ronald Reagan's freedom fighters in the 1980s. So we turned our back on our allies, the Taliban.
Well, a little more complicated than that, because the Taliban hadn't quite formed when we abandoned Afghanistan after the Soviet war, but I think there is a kind of a theme in U.S. thinking about Afghanistan since 9/11 that, you know, we should pay attention to the fact that we abandoned the country once after the Soviet war and we got 9/11. And so there's been a reluctance to draw down or to leave Afghanistan or to allow the Taliban to achieve a military victory because of the fear that we would just repeat the cycle of seeding international terrorism that we saw during the 1990s. And there is, I think, little doubt that if we just abandoned Afghanistan altogether now, that it would strengthen the Taliban and possibly the Islamic State, and that Afghanistan would find itself in a brutal civil war, even worse than the one it's in now, and that kind of instability would likely incubate terrorism, at least in the region. You know, one of the ironies of the war is that it's endless, we can't find a way out of it, and yet every government in the region, China, Pakistan, the Central Asian states, Iran, none of them wants to see Afghanistan collapse because they all fear that the violence will spill over into their country. And so they acknowledge that we're there on a counterterrorism mission that has some legitimacy. But what we really need to do is to take that common set of interests in the region and try to draw those governments into reducing the violence in Afghanistan and stabilizing the country. And we haven't really resourced that kind of a strategy the way we've resourced our own wars in Afghanistan.
Steve, you're the expert on this, but just a second ago you conflated ISIS and the Taliban. Would it be fair to say that the Taliban is different than ISIS in that the Taliban is only wants to have regional control, regional influence, whereas ISIS has kind of international ambitions? It wants to challenge the West on a wider basis.
Yes, I think that's right. I think the Taliban have not carried out terrorist attacks outside of their region. They have attacked, they accommodated hijackers of an Indian plane once before 2001, but otherwise their record of international terrorism is, vanishing. But they see themselves as a national liberation force under an Islamist banner. And the Islamic State sees itself as an international movement, a caliphate that will attack outside of its borders and has attacked and is proud of attacking in Europe and against the United States. I think that's an important difference, yes.
You write in your book that in Pakistan, the Inter-Services Intelligence, ISI, has played a shadowy role in boosting groups like the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. I thought we were allies with Pakistan. I thought Pakistan was a democracy and that it basically wanted generally the same kind of things that we do.
Well, we have hoped that that's the case, but it hasn't proved to be the case. So Pakistan is a democracy with a very powerful army that runs foreign policy and controls ISI and its covert action arm, which is referred to as Director Des. And the Pakistanis have calculated that because of their rivalry with India, they need these radical groups as a way to defend themselves against what they see as India's intentions to destabilize their country, maybe even destroy their country, certainly disarm their country. And, they have a smaller population than India, smaller military, and they have chosen this kind of asymmetric strategy of supporting radical Islamist groups to keep India off balance and to gain influence in Afghanistan, which, is their neighbor, and they have a long border with Afghanistan and a population that spills across the border, doesn't even recognize its legitimacy in some cases. And so they've used these groups to kind of carry out their foreign policy, even when those groups have been attacking American soldiers. That was the real frustration, was to discover circa 2007, 2008, that ISI, had allowed, had gone back to the playbook we worked with in the 1980s, even though the targets of the Afghan Taliban's attacks now were American soldiers at a time when the United States was providing massive amounts of aid to Pakistan. You know, they pleaded to us, this, we're too weak to stop this. We can't afford to crack down on these groups. We'll have a revolution against our government. And they were fighting violence at home. They were highly unstable in those years. But they also used these groups as a way to kind of manage their own problems at home by kind of pointing them at Afghanistan, pointing them at the Americans. You don't need to fight a war against the Pakistani state. Go attack the Americans.
So did the U.S. give money, lots of money, to the Pakistan ISI, and in turn they turned around and created these groups or have funded these militant groups in Afghanistan?
We did give a lot of money to the ISI, and they did tolerate initially and then gradually facilitate and support the groups that were attacking us in Afghanistan. Yeah, that was the frustrating narrative of the war as it developed, particularly between, you know, 2006 and 2012.
Hmm. You know, I'm wondering, what about negotiation? Does it make any sense, and have administrations tried negotiation with groups like the Taliban who only want regional influence? Have there been efforts to try to calm this situation down and just say, you know, the U.S. doesn't want to control, or maybe the U.S. does want to control this area because of rare minerals, I don't know. But have there been attempts to negotiate with groups like the Taliban?
Yeah, there have. It's a fascinating part of the book, I think. The secret negotiations that the Obama administration carried out with the head of the Taliban's political commission between late 2010 and 2013, roughly. So they lasted 2.5 years. They got the Pakistani ISI involved at different stages, but mostly we talked directly to this Taliban negotiator. And the idea initially was to try to build an understanding, confidence, allow the Taliban's kind of political strategy to emerge so that Afghans could, with U.S. brokering, negotiate something like a settlement, a constitutional settlement where the Taliban would lay down their arms and join politics in the country. And the talks failed, although I think the United States learned a lot from them. And, you know, one of the problems in the war is that everyone who leads it recognizes that you need an outcome like that, that this is not a war that's going to end on the battlefield. But they're reluctant to really enter into that kind of political negotiation until the Taliban are more battered, more defeated, more on their heels. The feeling is that, you know, we can't negotiate with them until we've put more pressure on them militarily. And yet that outcome has proved to be very difficult to achieve on the battlefield, even with, you know, 150,000 international troops and a lot of bombing. So I don't really see where a path to negotiations based on force is going to arise. I think, you know, if you look at the history of these kinds of wars, they can go on for a long time, but they always end with political negotiations. And, you know, even the British with the IRA, they were talking to the IRA long before they reached a final settlement. Probably that's the only way to try to get a better outcome than the one we have now.
And don't they always end with the foreign power being essentially thrown out? I mean, the history of the world is that if you're fighting for your own land, you win.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, it's very difficult to carry out an expeditionary war when you claim that you're defending a constitutional government, but the other side just sees you as an occupying power. A purpose of a political settlement in Afghanistan would be to allow the United States to reduce its presence in the country and to just support an Afghan government on terms the Afghan government wants. We say we don't want a permanent military presence in Afghanistan. That's what we tell the Afghans. We say we're only there to defend the constitutional government and to carry out a necessary counterterrorism mission until it's over. But now, we're also signaling that we could stay there for decades. So the Taliban kind of see that as a contradiction. In the secret talks during the Obama administration, it was very interesting. The Taliban took the position, yeah, we don't want you in our country as an occupying force, but we might want you to stay as a peacekeeping force after we negotiate this agreement, because we're worried that we're going to go back to a civil war. We may need an international peacekeeping force to kind of guarantee whatever it is we agree about during these negotiations. So they didn't sound like they were crazy. They were trying to figure out a way to come home and to participate in their national life.
So, Steve, in reading your book, I had the sense that I'm reading the Pentagon Papers not from the perspective of the Pentagon in Vietnam, but from the perspective of a journalist who's been in and out of Afghanistan and really seeing it for what it is, this longest U.S. war where thousands of American people have lost their lives, hundreds of thousands of Afghans have lost their lives. Is there a truth talker? Is there a truth teller, either in the Pentagon or in one of the administrations that you've covered, who sees things clearly and has spoken very honestly to the American people about the war in Afghanistan?
Well, there's a number of characters in the book, you know, in the intelligence services or in the, kind of experts in the State Department who really understand the cycles of failure in the war and start to speak up about them. Richard Holbrooke, who was Obama's special envoy to the war and who had been in Vietnam as a young Foreign Service officer and then had negotiated a political settlement in the Bosnian War, he came into the administration hoping he could steer negotiations with the Taliban towards some kind of political settlement. But there's a memo that he writes to Hillary Clinton just before he died in December 2010 that I quote in the book, in which he basically says, you know, our policy is failing. We keep saying that we're interested in politics and civilian-led strategy, but in fact, we're not, and we're not going to get a result on the battlefield. The best we can hope for, and this is literally his phrase, is a bloody stalemate. So he wrote that memo in 2010, and here we are in 2018, and we're still in that bloody stalemate. So, yeah, the information was in the system, but it wasn't digested. The president felt that he really had to support the war that he had inherited. President Obama, you know, he campaigned on a promise that he would turn attention to the good war, the important war, the war against al-Qaeda and in Afghanistan, and criticized the Bush administration over its performance in Iraq. So he was sort of trapped in his own campaign promises.
And do you think it's weird? I mean, just the other day, President Trump or somebody in the Trump administration suggested that we might send another 1,000 troops to Afghanistan. Do you think it's weird that almost any day you open up the paper, there's almost no news about Afghanistan?
Yeah, it is strange. I mean, it's really a forgotten war again, and it had become that by 2007 or so. The Iraq War was the dominant story on the front pages, and it wasn't until, you know, the war in Afghanistan really went bad that we started paying attention to it again, and by then it was too late to reverse it. And I think the crisis in Afghanistan today is a kind of forgotten war once again, and it's not just the military stalemate or the violence, the terrorism in the cities. There's lots of trouble in the whole project of democratic Afghan government, constitutional government. A lot of infighting, a lot of factionalism, and we're just not paying any attention to it as a country.
Steve,
hi, Rob. No, I'm so sorry to interrupt, but we have to run.
Okay, Steve Call, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you heard the sound of Steve Call's publicist there interrupt the interview because he had to go to his next one. Steve Call is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. His new book is called Directorate S, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And he is the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University in New York. Our phone number, we're going to open up the phone lines right now and take some phone calls. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. And our email address is dj@wmnf.org. During the top of the show, we heard seven or so phone calls from listeners about yesterday's program, about the shootout and barbecue in eastern Hillsborough County that's being planned by the Hillsborough County Republican Party. And one of the comments was saying the best question is where to draw the line. What are the weapons you can and cannot have. And somebody from the 352 area code writes this: you draw the line where the law is written. This is I guess it's Bob sending this in. And a Harrier jet is not a firearm, and RPGs are already banned. So there's Bob suggesting that we already know where the line is, that you can't have a Harrier jet, and you can't have rocket-propelled grenades. All right, so that's where the line is. I wasn't quite sure where the line is. I think a lot of people are not. 813-239-9663 is our phone number. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. We're going to gonna read just something from the front page of the Tampa Bay Times today and then listen to an interview that took place this morning on CNN. This is the lead story in the Tampa Bay Times this morning. Facing anguished relatives and classmates of shooting victims, a panel of Florida legislators took the unprecedented step Tuesday of creating a new statewide program to put armed teachers in classrooms over the vocal opposition of the Parkland residents. This article is by Steve Buskay, the Tallahassee bureau chief. He writes, voting along party lines, the House Appropriations Committee approved training teachers to carry guns in class under the direction of local law enforcement, if superintendents or the school boards approve. Representative Jose Oliva, a Republican from Miami Lakes, says the last line of defense, referring to teachers with guns, the $67 million school marshal program is the most controversial aspect of a House bill that imposes a three-day waiting period for gun purchases, raises the age to buy any gun from 18 to 21, and gives police more power to seize guns from people who threaten themselves or others. Most of the money for the marshal program would be spent on training. The proposals still need the approval of the full House and Senate, plus the signature of Governor Rick Scott to be enacted. Oliva said the bill doesn't address whether teachers would be provided guns or would have to buy them. He said that should be decided locally by school boards and school superintendents. The goal, 10 marshals, that is, teachers trained to carry a gun in every school, which would equate to 37,000 marshals statewide. The state would cover the costs of background checks, drug testing, psychological exams, and 132 hours of training. The bill does provide a one-time $500 stipend for those who volunteer to have a gun. So the House Appropriations Committee moving yesterday to arming teachers. What do you think about that? 813-239-9663. Email address is dj@wmnf.org. Jeff Haynes is our phone producer today. Let's go to Sean in Tampa before we go to the soundbite I want to play. Sean, you're on. What would you like to comment about?
How are you doing today?
I'm good. What's
thanks
up?
Thanks for taking my call. I really enjoy your show. So just real quick, the comment on the teachers carrying firearms. Okay. You know, so of course, like anything else, I don't agree with just any teacher carrying a firearm. Like President Trump was saying, I don't know that if the 20% of teachers in the United States are previously military members or law enforcement, you know, whatever that number may be. But you know, I think it's a common sense thing. If you have previous training and you're confident in carrying a firearm, I don't see an issue with it. I have three children of my own. I'm a full-time college student. That is a CCW carrier. I have 16 years of military experience. And I'll be honest with you, it's very frustrating knowing when I walk into a college campus that I can't carry my firearm. That really bothers me. But it also bothers me that there's a lot of schools in the area. Their schools are open.
Yeah, there's a lot of gun-free zones. Almost every restaurant, almost every hospital, almost every church, almost every synagogue. There's a lot of gun-free zones, including college campuses. Sean, let me ask you this: you were in the military. Let's say that that guns were now allowed on a college campus, and you saw a a shootout break out on the college campus, how would you identify who the good guys are and who the bad guys are? If there's several people on campus with guns, how would you, as a trained soldier, identify who would be the good guy and who would be the bad guy?
You know, that's a very good question. And that in itself is all dependent on the situation. And it all depends on what you see. Now, if you see two guys shooting it out, then of course, you don't get involved in a scenario like that. But I am trained to look at people's body language, to see how they're posturing. You know, if you're walking around a college campus, somebody pulls out a firearm and nobody else has firearms, I think that's a pretty good indication that they're gonna do something stupid.
Right, but let's assume that at the point that you have a firearm on campus, that a lot of other people are going to have firearms on campus. I mean, I've been to USF recently, and I see a lot of ex-military, even dressed in their fatigues, on campus. So let's assume that, you know, a bunch of people are going to have firearms. How do you determine who's the bad guy in a shootout situation?
Well, like I just said, you don't.
You look at their body language. That's what you said. Is that right? You would look at their body language, and then you'd figure out who the bad guy was.
If somebody's acting in an aggressive manner, pulls a firearm, and there's no...
Right, but remember, Sean, you're not the only one with a gun in campus. We've now allowed, because of your idea, we've allowed a lot of people to have guns, including a lot of the ex-military who are on every college campus here in the Tampa Bay area. How would you identify who the bad guy is? I'm still trying to figure that out, and I don't think I've heard an answer.
And you won't hear an answer because there's no way to tell.
But then how would having a shootout on campus and having you have a gun, how would that make us any safer?
Well, I didn't say a shootout.
Well, it's going to be a shootout. I mean, if you've got several people with guns and they're all going after the person they think is a bad guy, there's going to be some extra shots fired, don't you think?
If somebody understands that there's firearms on a campus, it's no longer a soft target. So carrying a firearm on campus is considered a deterrent. That's why security guards carry firearms. Very few security guards get into an active engagement.
Yeah, you know, you should look up the video of the security guards in New York City a few years ago when they couldn't figure out who the bad guy was, and they all started shooting at each other. Hey, Sean, thanks a lot. Thanks for your phone call. You started off quite a conversation. Great to have you here, Sean. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to Deanna in Largo. Hey, Deanna, you're on. What would you like to comment about?
Okay, this is what nobody is speaking of. So where is the teacher going to secure the gun when they have the gun on campus? Number two is, what if the kid now figures out who the teacher is that has the gun, and all they have to do is corner that teacher if it's carrying it, overpower that teacher, and then the child has the gun. If he confiscates the gun from the teacher who has it on concealed, he doesn't have to go buy it. He doesn't have to steal it. All he's got to do is knock the right teacher out, and he's got a gun.
So, Deanna,
when
the House Appropriations Committee moves to arming teachers here in the state of Florida, what message would you like to give them?
I would like to say, stop. There, we had an armed security guard. We had an armed officer on campus, and he didn't stop it. I think the money should go for mental health and for stopping the insanity of the multi-fired guns. If everybody is so crazy about their Second Amendment right, well, then they should all have one of those guns that they had at the time. You know, where they had to pack the powder, and they were one shooters. Then everybody can have a one shooter. So I'm happy with that. It's these multi shotguns and the assault rifles. And why does any one person need 10 guns? We have no hunting. We have no hunting. You have to go 400 miles to go hunting in Florida.
Self-counting. All right, Deanna, thanks a lot. Thanks for your thoughts.
That's how I see it.
All right.
Well, I really appreciate your format, Rob.
I'm glad you called in, Deanna. Thanks a lot. I think in fairness to hunters, though, there was a really great piece, and this is a little bit off topic, but Ben Montgomery, the former writer at the Tampa Bay Times, did a really great piece about hog hunting in Hillsborough County. So I think it's a little bit closer. But, Deanne, I know what you're saying is that the real hunting goes on, next to the Everglades and up in the Panhandle and near the Ocala National Forest. I think you're right. But there is some hunting that does go on in Hillsborough County. Let's go to Karen in Port Richey. Karen in Newport Richey, rather. Hey, Karen, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hi there.
Hi. What would you like to comment about?
Well, I think it'd be important to hear from a perspective of a teacher, and I am a teacher, and I did not, give up my corporate job to take on a teaching position because I wanted to carry a gun, and I think that, if I wanted to carry a gun and do something for the public, then I would have become a different type of public service. But I became a teacher because I want to, light the fire of learning in children's minds. I don't want to be an armed marshal. That's not why I became a teacher.
And Karen, you currently teach?
Yes.
And can you tell us, as this idea has come out of Tallahassee and is being talked about by President Trump, what are your fellow teachers saying to you about this? I mean,
I think that they're probably they need to really think good and hard about this because they are probably going to lose a lot of teachers. I think we're going to end up having a shortage of teachers.
And we already have a shortage of teachers here in Florida.
Right, yeah. And, like I said, I think it's just a sad commentary on the state of our society that we're actually considering arming teachers of all people who, yes, were there to protect children and create a safe environment for learning, but I don't think it should be up to the teachers to create that safe environment. I think it should be up to our legislators. I think it should be up to the people that construct schools. I think it should be up to families to, create a nurturing environment where children aren't coming to school hungry, where we have mental health issues are supported. It's very frightening that this is what our society is coming to. And I think that I have a lot of hope because I do teach high schoolers, and I see an amazing group of kids coming up. And I think, as Obama said, they're going to be the ones we're waiting for to make a change.
All right, Karen, thanks a lot. Thanks for your comments.
All right.
Bye-bye. Great to hear from you. And Scott writes this, the idea of arming teachers is ludicrous, writes Scott. And he says that doesn't solve the problem about what nightclubs like Pulse, which are basically gun-free zones, Scott is pointing out. What about churches? We can't all carry machine guns, writes Scott. Diallo writes this, so we have money to buy teachers guns, but no money to pay teachers a raise, writes Diallo. And Alita writes, someone should have trained your first caller, that guy Sean, to think, writes Alita. Lou in Clearwater writes, so if teachers carry firearms and are going to serve and protect, will they be able to join the police union and get the same benefits as police? And they should get paid the same as police officers. I'm willing to bet every one of them will volunteer to carry under those circumstances, writes Lou. And we're discussing whether or not teachers should be armed. I was planning to play some sound from one of the Parkland victims, but we'll just keep taking some phone calls from listeners. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Let's go to Valerie in Tampa. Hi, Valerie. You're on MNF. What would you like to say?
Hi, good morning. I was actually in that committee hearing.
In Tallahassee yesterday?
It was Monday.
Okay.
It was Monday. I boarded a bus at 3 a.m. from Tampa, and the bus was full of basically half adults and half students. There were over 1,000 people at that rally, It was interesting to note that not one Republican senator that was a part of that committee or took any of our meetings. We went to each and every office. None of them were there to hear our concerns. And the most disturbing thing of all is that they have actually combined two bills. Initially, the bill to arm teachers was separate. They've combined the two bills so that all of the other issues, the mental health initiative, the raising the age to 21, all are now one bill. So if you're going to vote for those other initiatives, you're going to have to vote to arm the teachers as well.
Yeah, so they've combined good parts and bad parts, and they're forcing the legislators to vote on a bill that's mixed. Valerie, are you saying that you think state legislators were hiding from you and the students?
Oh, they absolutely were.
Okay.
There was no doubt. In fact, I posted a video. There was one that just ran out of his office. And like a scared little rabbit.
So where can people see that video, Valerie?
Well, it's on my Facebook page. Where I'm actually interviewing his aide, who has, you know, no idea.
Okay.
Where he was going and in such a hurry.
And they call liberals snowflakes.
Right.
Yeah.
The snowflakes were standing in the pouring rain at that rally.
Valerie, thanks a lot. Thanks. Thanks for giving us the insight.
Can I make one more point?
Please do.
Okay. The point of training, the whole, there's so many flaws, but one glaring one is that the training period for these teachers, a SWAT team trains for 3 to 6 months to handle active shooters. And we're going to train the teacher for 3 weeks.
And you're going to get a $500 stipend, too, for that training. Is that...
Right. Well,
it's, you're right. It's ludicrous. It's ludicrous. No doubt about it.
Anyway.
All right, Valerie.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks a lot. Great to hear from you. Amin writes, teachers are humans, too. I even heard that they take stress pills. What's the guarantee that the teacher won't flip and turn on their students or even their coworkers, writes Amin. And Ernie writes, being in the military means nothing. It's what the person did in the military that matters, writes Ernie. And you're listening to a live show here on WMNF in Tampa. Let's go to Mike in Land O'Lakes, who says that he was military trained. Mike, you're on. What would you like to say about teachers and guns?
Well, first of all, I have three daughters in public school, and I think it's just ludicrous. And the one thing that's bothered me about all of this is that I haven't heard one person say, are we going to make the teachers go through a serious mental health check before you arm them with a gun? That lady just said, teachers are human too. So there are teachers in our society that have their own issues. As we've seen before, with all these teachers having sex with kids, doing drugs with kids, all that stuff. I'm real biased towards my teachers. My mother was an educator for 36 years, and she'd look at this and she'd say, I'm glad I'm out. Because my mom hates guns. She hates guns, but she said people have the right to have them. My only problem with this is simple. I grew up in the projects in Belmont Heights in the 80s when they had two riots. You know how they made Belmont Heights a better place to live?
How'd they do it?
They put more police officers on the streets. They didn't tell more citizens to take up guns. Okay? You need to put more. I know those officers down at that high school performed badly. At least some of them did. But at the end of the day, some of these high schools have 3,000 and 4,000 kids with one officer. That's ridiculous. How about for high schools, you make it mandatory for three officers, junior high two, and in Pasco County, not elementary school, some of them don't even have one.
Yeah.
So they got to figure it out in order to just give an English teacher that has a bad haircut a 9mm.
Yeah. All right, Mike, thanks a lot. Thanks for your comments. Great to hear from you. Thanks a lot. Let's go to Polly in Sarasota. Hi, Polly. You're on WMNF. What do you think about teachers and guns?
Thanks for taking my call. It appears that it's getting worse as far as any type of legislative rulings. I think maybe what could happen is instead of a hunger strike, there should be a school strike. And us parents, we need to keep our kids home from school. Teachers need to stay home until something's done. I mean, it's been a few weeks, and really, things aren't going to get any better. If you put guns in the hands of teachers, it's dangerous. It's ludicrous, just like everybody's thinking. But I think the people are going to have to come together and take action, because nothing's going to get done right now. And my daughter's in high school here in Sarasota, at Sarasota High, and she's terribly frightened to go to school. And my son is homeschooled, and, you know, that's another choice for people. You know, and maybe that's what the government wants. You know, maybe they look at this as an opportunity to put limitations on school and tax dollars and what have you. But it doesn't serve any. It doesn't solve the problem with churches, with shopping malls, with concerts, and
restaurants. Yeah. All right, Pauly, thanks a lot. I wish we had more time. We're out of time. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Great to hear from you. And 941 writes, if teachers get guns, they will be the first target. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. And I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned.